Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 103 for May 31st, 2011. My name is Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm David Liu.
And we've got three stories as usual. First, we're going to talk about what happens when you mess with the mama bear. Hint, you get the claws. Second, we're going to talk about PayPal versus Google and a new lawsuit that was filed. And finally, whether or not GoDaddy can be liable for a wrongful transfer of a domain name. So the first story we're talking about is, as I mentioned, messing with the mama bear. And this is a story that we covered, I believe, last time on the podcast, which was a company, a non-practicing patent holder called Loadsys, had sent demand letters to several app developers. And those app developers contacted Apple and basically said, "Hey, Apple, can you do something about this?" And Apple was very quiet for about 10 days after the story broke, and then sent a letter to Loadsys and sent that letter to the Apple developers who were being targeted. And we'll post a link to the letter in the show notes, but essentially it says, "Dear Loadsys, we licensed this patent from you, and we were under the impression that that meant that our licensees would not be sued. These are the reasons why our licensees shouldn't be sued. Here's one reason, here's the second reason, here's the third reason, and here's a fourth reason. Balls in your court, Loadsys." So, I imagine everyone on the call has gotten a chance to read this.
Yep.
Initial thoughts? Do you think that Apple's correct?
Well, I'm sure the developers are breathing a giant sigh of relief.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it looks like Apple's correct from what I can tell, in that if they license, because their basic argument is, "Hey, we license your technology that lets people use an in-app store, basically. And since the developers are using our API to implement your functionality, they're actually using our code, which we have licensed. So they're not actually writing their own code. They're using our code because they're using our API, which uses your licensed technology."
Yeah, another Apple, a corollary to that was, Apple says, "Listen, all of the things that, you know, you think are infringing are happening on our side of the equation. You know, it's the fact that people are sending this information to the App Store, it's being stored by the App Store and then being retransmitted to the phone. That's all on Apple's side. That's not any information. That's, you know, none of those actions are happening in that person's code. So, you know, again, we've got the license to do it and we're properly doing it with the license."
Pretty much, yeah.
The argument I found most interesting was the patent exhaustion. And patent exhaustion is something I believe we've talked about on the podcast before.
Many podcasts ago, though.
Yes. And basically, patent exhaustion says, if I license a patent from Dominic and I make something from that patent, like I make a product using that patent, then I sell the product, Dominic can't go and sue the person who's using the product that I sold them, because you've already extracted, Dominic, your one monopoly rent from the use of that patent, and that
right.
was to give it to me so that I could make something with it. You can't go to everyone down the line and also try to extract a monopoly.
Right, to give a silly example, just to make this a little more concrete, say that I have a patent on a method of pouring ice cream into an ice cream cone, and you have an ice cream shop and you license the patent and you use my ice cream process to put ice cream into cones, which you then sell to customers. I can't sue those customers and say, "Hey, you haven't paid me for eating an ice cream that's been put into a cone using my patent technology, because the patent's been exhausted because it's gone through you."
You know, sometimes we make fun of these silly little examples, but these actually do occasionally help me understand what's going on.
Right. I'm trying to think of an example that may be a little more on the nose, but I mean, that one's good.
It's just a first sale. It's just honestly a first sale doctrine when applied to patents.
Right. And interesting thing about that is that the first sale doctrine, as it applies to copyright, which we've talked about more recently on the podcast, is in a statute. But it's just been common law that basically a court-prescribed rule that's applied the first sale doctrine to patents.
So does there need to be something in particular in the licensing that Apple did to get a license from Loadsys to make this apply to this case? Because, I mean, I read Apple's response and I was like, okay, you know, that seems like it's could be one interpretation of your contract depending on what the actual contract says. So, I mean, is that a generalizable legal principle, or does it depend on what's actually here?
What do you mean in terms of whether Apple's argument that the fact that they license the patents necessarily protects their licensees, or?
Yeah, I mean, does that depend on the actual wording of the license, which I didn't actually see anywhere?
Theoretically, it would, but the default license, unless they specifically tried to exclude that right, would include what Apple alleges it would include.
Right. Okay. So in copyright, the first sale doctrine only applies to sales. It doesn't apply to licenses. But in the case that Apple cites, Quanta versus LG Electronics, the Supreme Court leans a little towards saying that first sale even applies to certain licenses in the patent world. If I mean, that's a real oversimplification of Quanta v. LG, but that's the nugget of it, that even if there's just a license, there are cases where first sale doctrine will apply to a license of a patent as opposed to a sale of an item that was patented.
So to sort of briefly summarize what happened in Quanta versus LG, LG had effectively they had some patents on processing information, and they entered into contracts with Intel. And in this license agreement, they basically said that no license is granted to any third party for combining licensed products with other products. So Intel couldn't combine the microprocessors with other parts of a computer. But the license agreement also said that notwithstanding anything contrary to contained in this agreement, the parties agree that nothing herein shall in any way limit or alter the effect of patent exhaustion that would otherwise apply when a party hereto sells any of its licensed product. In other words, they had patent exhaustion is going to continue to exist, but you can't put our products into anything else without a permission. Intel sold these products that used LG's patented processing information techniques, and then Quanta Computer, another company, bought them, or specifically, they bought the Intel licensed microprocessor products. And then they turned around and made computers with them, which, on the face of it, would seem to violate the license. Effectively, the court said that the patent exhaustion doctrine is going to trump these things here. Basically, that because the agreement had said patent exhaustion is going to hold, the part of the license that said you can't combine this, that you can't use this licensed patent technology, was invalidated because patent exhaustion trumped effectively, because LG tried to sue Quanta. Did that make sense?
I think so, yeah.
Yes, it made sense to the extent that the law surrounding patent exhaustion is clear and easy to understand.
Yeah, and I was kind of cutting it a little close, because actually the Supreme Court refused to consider the issue whether a contract can even eliminate the exhaustion doctrine itself. They kind of got around it through various legal tricks, if you will.
Yeah, and as of now, we're waiting to see if Lodesys has any public response to this, which, as of this record date, which is the 29th of May, they do not.
Yeah, and we should mention the last time we discussed this was back episode 101, and also in the intervening weeks, Lodesys did come out publicly with a couple of different responses to the original sort of mystery of what was going on in this case, and they published an FAQ on their blog, which had, you know, some answers to some questions of, you know, why they were going after the particular app developers and not Apple, and so on and so forth. Which I thought had some kind of interesting logic to it. Basically, at one point they stated that, I'm quoting here from their blog, since Lodesys patent rights are of value to that overall solution, it is only fair to get paid by the party that is accountable for the entire solution and which captures the value rather than a technology supplier or a retailer. And so then they go into this fun little analogy of a hotel. And if there's a problem with the hotel, you sue the owner of the hotel and not the owner of the land or the people who make the steel beams that make the hotel. And I guess they're calling the app developers the owner of the hotel. Did you guys have any thoughts on that if you read through that?
I mean, it's obviously not a perfect analogy that if... Well, for one, I mean, the FAQ was written before Apple came out with their letter, basically, you know, stepping in front of the app developers. But, I mean, Apple isn't really the owner of the land. I mean, I don't know, you could make that argument, but it just does... It's not a great analogy. And, you know, in patent law, you go after the person who's infringing, and in this case, Apple thinks that they're the people who are infringing or, you know, that they're the licensees. And meanwhile, Lodestar thinks that the individual app developers are the licensees and the people who are, should be the licensees and are the people who are infringing. So it's not a great analogy. You wouldn't go after the, you know, the company that, you know, manufactured the iPhone because the iPhone is capable of infringing, and there's infringing software running on the iPhone. So, you know.
Go ahead.
I mean, you can take the analogy in any number of directions, and it doesn't work particularly well in many of them.
Yeah, the latest activity from Lodestar, they haven't responded to Apple, but they have turned around and sued a couple Android developers for the same thing they sued the iOS developers for, basically in-app purchasing. So it'll be interesting to see whether Google comes forth to say anything in this case.
I'm still a little amused at the language that Lodestar used, that analogy being one, and then at another part they say that these, quote, the scope of the current licenses does not enable them, being Apple, to provide their, quote, pixie dust to bless another business application, which I just think is funny.
Yeah, that's not a real legal term that I've ever seen before. Have you, Dominic?
No, I've never seen that term, but I mean, lawyers get creative or think they get creative.
I mean, what we were saying before is that this license does, in fact, enable them to bless these other applications with the ability to use this patent.
Well, again, if they're using Apple's API, then technically these applications themselves are never implementing the methods themselves. They're just using the methods themselves, which is the distinction that the patent exhaustion doctrine makes. It's not like they're ignoring what Apple... They're using Apple's code. Apple's making them use their code. So make it their code available to them for use.
Okay. Any last thoughts, David?
All set.
And Dominic?
All set here.
So take it away.
So our next story concerns PayPal and Google Wallet. Google recently announced Google Wallet, I think at the I.O. conference, right? Or was it somewhere else?
Yeah, I think it was Google I.O.
I think it was the last day of I.O. Basically, the whole idea behind Google Wallet is with a NFC-enabled phone, in other words, something with near-field capacity, I think that's what that stands for. Basically, you can just wave your phone next to one of those those readers, and then it'll pay using your phone instantly. Pretty cool. PayPal, near-field communication. Thanks, Ben. PayPal turned around and said, hey, wait a second. This is very similar to what we were working with, and you actually hired two people away from us back in 2009 and then in 2010. And your Google Wallet product is actually a misappropriation of all our trade secrets, because we had Stephanie Tilneus, who was the president and general manager of eBay, which owns PayPal, and then the vice president of payments at Google, Osama Bieder, was at PayPal as the social media strategist and vice president of product development. And one of his final projects, ironically enough, maybe not ironically, involved a deal between Google and PayPal regarding mobile payments. Trade secret cases are always fun because it's always very difficult to figure out what the hell the trade secret is because no one wants to tell you, but PayPal's basically alleging that Google Wallet is something that is spawned by virtue of these two executives' unique knowledge of PayPal's particular systems and what PayPal was planning to do. So it's going to be pretty significant litigation in terms of PayPal versus Google. And again, if you look through the complaint, basically they're saying that Google recruited this executive while he was negotiating for PayPal against Google, using, for example, when the Android market launched, Google wanted to potentially use PayPal as a method of paying for apps, and he was in charge of those negotiations. And then when the negotiations fell apart, he got a job offer, or before the negotiations fell apart, he got a job offer, then the negotiations fell apart, and he swapped over to Google. And when he got the job offer, he let PayPal know, and PayPal told them that, hey, because you know all about our mobile payment system, point of sale, and digital wallet in the cloud ideas, you can't take this job because you'll be misappropriating our trade secrets. And he went ahead and took the job. The weird thing about this case is he was offered the job in November 2010. PayPal's not actually suing until now, which is May 2011, and when Google Wallet was announced. I guess what I don't personally understand is why they didn't sue right when they hired this guy instead of waiting for the product to come about. Did they have to in order for the trade secret to be misappropriated instead of just the risk of misappropriation?
Yeah, that would be my thought, that until Google had released a product or until PayPal had concrete knowledge that trade secrets had been misappropriated, they didn't have any harm. Because trade secret, to sue over a misappropriated trade secret, you need the trade secret to be, you know, misappropriated, and it has to be by some inappropriate means. And if, you know, this guy, these two people just went over to Google and didn't reveal any trade secrets, then there would be no harm.
Right, that makes sense. So Osama Bedier, who is the sort of the, I'm not sure if pronouncing his last name correctly, but Bedier. He was sort of the brains, I guess. And Stephanie Tilneus, she was the vice president of electronic commerce at Google, but she had worked with Bedier at eBay and PayPal before she had left eBay a year before he left eBay. And she had, when she had joined eBay back in 2001, she had agreed not to solicit any employees for a period of a year after the end of her employment, as well as not to tell any, not to say any trade secrets. And then she reaffirmed those commitments when she signed her separation agreement in 2009 on October 16th. Then, not quite a year later, so theoretically within the terms of the 1 year bar of trying to solicit eBay or PayPal employees, she actually messaged Mr. Osama Bedier and saying, I heard from a little birdie that you might be open to bigger and better challenges. I have a huge opportunity for you. Would love to chat if you're interested. So in other words, she was trying to recruit him in direct violation of what she had signed with eBay, or so PayPal, which is a subsidiary of eBay, alleges. And perhaps without her trying to recruit him, he wouldn't have swapped over to Google. And then perhaps without that, they would have used... wouldn't have come up with Google Wallet, which allegedly misappropriates the PayPal trade secrets. But reading through this complaint, they haven't really said what the trade secrets are, and this is sort of the nature of trade secret litigation, in that you can't really put what the secret is in the complaint, because the complaint is public, and it kind of wastes the trade secret if anyone reading it can be like, oh, that's actually a great idea. Because if you actually publish a trade secret publicly, then you are no longer trying to keep it a secret, and it loses its protection. So, go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, for what it's worth, it's not unusual to file a public complaint and then a private impounded complaint. So one complaint that's released to the public and one complaint that stays under seal in the court, where only the parties have access to it.
Yeah. So PayPal basically says, hey, we have these trade secrets. They've been stolen. There's also been illegal activity or in violation of contractual agreements that we've signed with our former employees in terms of not swapping over to competitors and not recruiting other employees after they do swap over. So
Plus, there's another wrinkle in that Bettier, or Mr. Bettier, had admitted to having some confidential information on his non-work computers and such. So the complaint is listing this stuff, you know, non-PayPal computers, non-PayPal email accounts, plus he had some files in Dropbox, apparently. And PayPal had asked those to be returned, or for at least to have a third party look through that information and see whether there was anything infringing. It seems he has refused to do that as well, which they are claiming means that he intends to use these trade secrets and keep them.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty interesting part of the case, that he admits to having used Dropbox, which we've talked about a couple times in this podcast, to store confidential information, and theoretically that he can... Basically, their view is that he has PayPal trade secrets in his Dropbox, and since he still has access to Dropbox, that Dropbox account, he shouldn't be holding on to PayPal trade secrets. It's effectively the same in the practical sense as if he had photocopied a bunch of stuff before he quit and then took it with him. People would want to get all those trade secrets back. But because of the way that technology works with Dropbox, he doesn't need to photocopy it. It just kind of, he was working on it and he was using it as remote backup, but now it's still there. And the actual funny thing about Dropbox is if you delete anything on your Dropbox, it's still stored for several months afterwards. So even if he had deleted everything he had, perhaps in front of someone who was the guy making sure that he left the company, then he could just log into Dropbox a week later and be like, oh, actually, I didn't mean to delete that stuff, and have it all restored to him. So I'm not entirely sure what the solution for him there is, apart from maybe turning over the entire Dropbox account. But he might have perhaps a mix of personal and private stuff. Like, he might not want to give his entire Dropbox account because he might have personal family photos or whatever that he doesn't necessarily want eBay to have.
So there was a semi-related story this week. This case sort of involves this agreement that you signed as a part of working at eBay, which was saying that you won't recruit from eBay once you leave. And there was another interesting case that we're not talking about as a main story this week, between a number of individuals, and they were suing Adobe, Apple, Google, Intel, Intuit, Lucasfilm, and Pixar, and I guess a couple others, for basically creating a big old monopoly, or I don't know what the proper term is here, but for all these, all those companies had non-solicitation deals between the companies, and that sort of led them to fix employee pay. And so I just wanted to mention it just because it's sort of in the same environment of tech companies and how the very forceful recruiting between these companies can create odd environments, one result being this eBay Google story, and then the other one being this antitrust act. So,
any thoughts, Ben?
No, I'm all set. I mean, there's been ongoing litigation and kind of fighting about recruiting people like that for a while now, because California has the state of California doesn't enforce non-competes. Companies have kind of resorted to other things to try to keep employees from jumping around too much, but you get into antitrust complaints like we just heard about, and both individual and state suits based on that. And, it's an interesting fight between the companies who kind of want to respect each other's talent and the same companies who also want to capture each other's talent.
Any other thoughts on the trade secrets story in general?
All set.
I'm all set too. So I guess that brings us to our third story of the podcast, involving GoDaddy. So there's a gentleman, Jeff Eysoldt, I believe I'm pronouncing that right, Eysoldt, and he had registered the account, the domain iSolt.com through the company GoDaddy. And he used this for a lot of personal things, storing photos and email for himself and a number of his family members. And he had also registered a URL for a company called ProScan, which he was trying to do some business with. I guess it's to promote cosmetic surgery centers. But that business deal went sour. And so there was this other domain, myrejuvenate.com, which ProScan believed that they owned, and even though Mr. Iselt had registered it. And so after that deal broke through, or broke down, sorry, ProScan went to GoDaddy and asked them to transfer the domain over to them, and they verified this by verifying the payment information that was used to register this domain. And so what GoDaddy did was, I guess, a little surprising to me, which is that they gave ProScan control over the MyRejuvenate domain, but they also gave them control over the iSolt.com account. And ultimately, this led, there's a little bit of back and forth, but iSolt sued GoDaddy and ProScan for this. And in the end, the jury rewarded iSolt with $50,000, as well as some of his family members. So, initial reactions to this case, gentlemen?
Kind of, GoDaddy, they also asked him to verify, and then they were like, your face isn't legible on your driver's license. We can't verify that you're really you, which is hilariously incompetent.
I mean, it's also hilarious that, I mean, they were relying on I think it was a fax scan of his driver's license to verify his identity when, you know, they had been dealing with him already, and presumably he was able to contact them through the same methods that he had contacted them. And so, yeah. I mean, that probably, to me, it seems more like GoDaddy thinking that they really shouldn't have transferred the iSolt domain, and then it's just going to hassle them, hoping that it goes away.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure why they didn't split the domains. I mean, they were all in one account, but they apparently gave access to everything in his account to ProScan, which is kind of odd. He just registered the domain name, right? Or did he actually store, did he use GoDaddy for hosting?
I'm looking through here to see if it says anything.
I guess he had emails being hosted by GoDaddy on those domain names, so theoretically someone at ProScan could access his personal emails on the iSolt.com account. The court cites that that GoDaddy took control of personal emails and communications and handed them over to a third party, which they shouldn't have done.
Fair to say.
And so maybe this is familiar to the more lawyer-inclined listeners that we have to this podcast, but I just wanted to break down the rewards that iSolt got for this. So he got $20,000 of the $50,000 for invasion of privacy, which is a term that I am familiar with. But the other $30,000 was for conversion. And can you guys just define that for me?
Using and gaining some benefit from something that isn't yours. So, for example, David Liu, if I broke into your house, took your computer, and used it for my own personal gain, that would be conversion. It's kind of the non-criminal version of theft.
Got it. So that was one of the arguments that GoDaddy was trying to make, was that this I guess, was not the basis of a conversion action because the domain name was intangible property.
Yeah, and that's an argument that may have flown 20 years ago, but domain names are clearly valuable things.
Right, and that also relates to one of the other arguments that they made, which was that since there was no real money being made here, just since he was using it for personal use, more or less, that there wasn't enough economic loss to justify them awarding money for it. But the court ruled that this applies to negligence claims and not to intentional torts. I assume that meant something to you.
So there's a rule that says if I'm suing you for negligence, I can't sue you just because there's some economic loss that happened to me. Like, I'm trying to think of a good example here. There has to be some physical harm that goes along with it. And that's because, you know, typical negligence is kind of focused on making somebody, you know, the person whole. Meanwhile, for intentional torts like conversion, you can recover even if it's just economic harm, even if there's no, you know, physical damage to either you or something else.
But since this was more intentional, then that economic loss didn't matter. That makes sense.
Right. That it was only economic loss doesn't matter. Dominic, any thoughts on your end?
It's a pretty straightforward case in terms of just him not GoDaddy doing something they shouldn't have done, and the privacy violations are pretty interesting, and the court's holding on conversion is actually probably the most noteworthy part of the case, I think, because it used to be that you couldn't domain names used to not be able to be usable for conversion because of their intangible property, whereas now the court basically says that, well, everyone knows what a domain name is, so it's kind of tangible in that sense.
All right, so any final thoughts on this story? Dominic?
All set.
Mr. Snikoff?
I'm all set. Take us out, David.
All right, well, I'd like to thank you for listening to the 103rd episode of our podcast. As always, you can contact us through our website, technicallylegal.org, or on Twitter, @TechLegal. I'm David Liu.
I'm Dominic Rebbe.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
Thank you very much. Have a pleasant week.